From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, seances. Here's what's happening. Sadly, more bodies were found in the rubble of a condo collapse in Surfside, Florida tonight, pushing the confirmed death toll now to 54, with another 86 people still unaccounted for. Search and rescue efforts to find survivors amid the rubble of the building have become increasingly grim. According to most rescue personnel, they are combing through the rubble. They found no evidence that anyone has survived that initial collapse. New UC Berkeley University research draws a strong link between cell phone radiation and tumors, particularly in the brain. The researchers took a comprehensive look at statistical findings from 46 different studies around the globe and found that the use of a cell phone for more than 1,000 hours, or about 17 minutes a day, that's it, over a 10-year period, increased the risk of tumors by 60%. Folks, if you have the way to do it, just use your speaker on your phone and hold it a little bit away from you. The Delta variant is already the dominant strain of COVID-19 in the United States now, according to the CDC. According to the health agency's estimates, the Delta variant became dominant in the country over the last 2 weeks, ending July 3rd, with almost 52% cases linked to the variant that was first identified in India. And the White House has sought to clarify its new door-to-door coronavirus vaccine push amid fresh criticism from the right that the home visit approach is government overreach. What do you think of that? The press secretary has stressed that no one from the federal government will be showing up at your door mandating coronavirus vaccines. Rather, the personal visits that President Biden announced are designated to share information on the vaccinations as the White House aims to still reach its 4th of July goal of having 70% of the adult population jabbed. I don't know about you, but you don't want any government officials knocking on your door. It doesn't sound good. Let's check in with Howard Bloom with that same question. Howard?
Here are the facts. Joe Biden, as part of his new 5-point push to get America vaccinated, has announced that he will have teams go from door to door to explain that the vaccine is safe and to provide information about how and where to get the jab. But Representative Van Crenshaw of Texas objects, how about not knocking on my door? You're not my parents. You're the government. Make the vaccines available and let people be free to choose. Why is that concept so hard for the left? And Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich says he is greatly alarmed. Now, why would the idea of folks going from door to door like United Fund volunteers be alarming? Because our war with COVID-19 is being undermined by politics. 18 states are now 70% vaccinated. They're able to go back to business as usual with a minimum risk of COVID infections. But 32 states are below the vaccination level of 70%. Vaccination matters. All of the new COVID deaths, all of them hitting the United States right now, are in unvaccinated people. In other words, if you're vaccinated against COVID-19, you're relatively safe. If you are not vaccinated, you could be dead. Here's where the politics come in. Those 18 states above the 70% vaccination level all voted for Joe Biden. The 32 states that remain in danger because of low vaccination rates all voted for Donald Trump. And here's why politics has this impact. There are two radically different political narratives on the COVID-19 vaccine. The left believes that COVID vaccines can save the world from a global pandemic. The right believes the vaccines are experimental drugs, that over 7,000 people have been killed by the vaccines, and that these deaths are being covered up. What's more, many on the right believe that the entire COVID crisis is a vast left-wing conspiracy. Millions believe that the vaccines contain microchips designed by Bill Gates to monitor your every move, that these microchips are the mark of the beast that the Bible warned against, that the vaccines are satanic, that Dr. Anthony Fauci is secretly making billions from the vaccines, and that Joe Biden is enacting a full-scale Marxist takeover of the United States. What's more, millions believe that under Joe Biden, a war against Christianity is being waged, and that an elite of child-raping, child-eating Satanists is behind it all. The left, on the other hand, believes in the power of the vaccine to stop COVID in its tracks. So when Joe Biden proposes knocking on doors in his effort to get all of us vaccinated, to some it is a patriotic duty to say no and to resist the Marxist, totalitarian, satanic takeover of the United States. The problem is that when I choose not to get vaccinated, I endanger you. If the COVID virus manages to invade my body, even if it doesn't make me sick, it will use me as a research and development lab. It will use me to come up with new variants, variants with new abilities to end run your immune system and to outfox your vaccines. It will use me to be fruitful and multiply so it can spread to you, so it can affect your parents and your kids. And there's one final problem. COVID deaths and cases have dropped to one-tenth of their level under the previous administration. But part of that is because it's summer when viruses find it harder to spread. Meanwhile, 50%, as you said, 52% of new U.S. COVID cases are the Delta variant from India, and that variant is more contagious and more deadly than any variant we have seen before. So we are up against a deadline. Vaccinate 70% of the people before the fall, or we are likely to have a COVID fourth wave, and that fourth wave is likely to concentrate on killing Republicans.
That's a strange one, Howard. Strange ones indeed. Sleep loss catches us with very quickly. According to a new study out of the University of Southern Florida, researchers say all it takes is three consecutive nights of sleep loss to experience a great deterioration in both mental and physical well-being. A poor night's sleep was defined as any evening in which an individual slept less than the universally recommended 6 to 8 hours a night. Haiti's president was killed during an attack on his private residence early on Wednesday, according to the country's acting prime minister. The attackers stormed his home around 1 a.m. and shot him to death and also critically wounded his wife. Tense times in Haiti. Former President Donald Trump has sued three tech giants, Facebook, Twitter, and Google, and the firm's chief executives after the platforms took various steps to ban him or block him from posting. Let's check in with our expert, Mish Shedlock. Mish, what do you think of this one?
Well, this is kind of interesting. Now, Trump claims he was banned for exercising his constitutional right of free speech. That's according to the lawsuit. Well, that's not true. He was banned for repeatedly violating policy. Now, we can argue all day about whether the policy was any good or not, but Trump, you know, went against stated policy. They warned him not to make claims about the election, about allegations of widespread fraud. Some people believe that, but he was warned, don't do it. He did it, and he was banned. So, ironically, when he was president, Trump sometimes blocked individuals who criticized him for following his Twitter account. That's the politics of it. First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams, he's a constitutional expert and author of Soul of the First Amendment. He's argued 13 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. He called Trump's lawsuits irredeemably frivolous. You know, that's how I believe the courts are going to rule.
They're
going to
toss these out, aren't they?
But what is it really about, George? Here's the key point. I think this is about finances. The media is not paying much attention to Trump. He's losing his social media, and that was a key method for him of raising money. He wants that method back. It's a long shot. That's the shot he's taking. Whether or not you agree with him is a matter of politics. But this is going to be decided not on the basis of politics, but on the basis of law.
We shall see what happens, Mish. Thank you so much. Up next, fascinating couple hours with Earl Swift. His latest work is called Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover, and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Earl Swift. Began writing for a living in his teens. In the years since, the Virginia-based journalist has penned 7 books and hundreds of major features for newspapers and magazines, has earned a reputation for fast-moving narratives and scrupulous reporting. His editors have nominated his work for the National Book Award, the National Magazine Award, 7 times for a Pulitzer Prize, a former Fulbright Fellow in New Zealand. Swift has also been a fellow of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities at the University of Virginia since 2012. Great honors, Earl. Welcome to the program.
George, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Tell me about this incredible work, Across the Airless Wilds. Who would ever think about writing a book about the rovers? Great idea.
Well, thank you. I turned 13 on the day that Apollo 15 landed on the moon in July of 1971, and have a very clear recollection of that mission and the two that followed it. I don't have so clear a memory of those that came before. I remember my parents being very excited about Apollo 11, but you know, I wasn't 10 yet, and I just don't recall it much.
Which is interesting, because most of us don't remember the ones you remember.
Well, that's exactly right. But one of the reasons I remember them so clearly is that the astronauts had a car.
Yep.
And, you know, it seemed the ultimate American touch to, extraterrestrial exploration to put the astronauts in a tiny go-kart, a four-wheeler, and set them loose on the lunar surface. And unknown to the 13-year-old me, it completely revamped the Apollo program. It remade the missions. They were completely different once the rover arrived.
We were friends with Edgar Mitchell, the late astronaut on Apollo 14, and that came right before 15, 16, 17 came with a lot of their rovers, right?
It did. We sent six pairs of astronauts onto the lunar surface between 1969 and 1972, and the first three were pedestrian missions. The astronauts walked. The last three had rovers, and Ed Mitchell was on 14, which was a pretty ambitious mission, but was hamstrung by the fact that its astronauts were on foot and severely limited in getting around.
How big were these rovers?
They were tiny. If you were to...
Yeah, I guess they had to be, huh?
Well, they did, because they had to fold up and fit aboard the lunar module, which was not a giant spacecraft to begin with. If you were to park a rover next to a modern Mazda Miata, which is one of the smallest cars on the road today, mm-hmm. The Miata outstretches it by close to 2.5 feet.
Wow. And what was its propulsion, a battery?
Had two batteries that drove four tiny electric motors, one in each wheel. Each motor was a quarter horsepower, so the total motive brawn of the rover was one horsepower, much like a shop vac or a weed whacker.
Apollo 11, 12, 13, 14, they were relatively short-distance lunar excursions. The other ones, 15 and 16 and 17, didn't they go miles?
They did. And, you know, it's worth remembering just how short those first missions were. Of course, 13 was the shortest of all. They didn't get to the moon. But 11, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped onto the lunar surface in July of 1969, and their travels on the surface would fit inside a football field with a lot of yardage to spare. The farthest that either man walked from the lunar module was about 65 yards.
Jeez. Now, contrary, how far did the other ones go, 15, 16, and 17?
Well, 15 drove more than 17 miles.
Whoa!
16 drove more than 16 miles. On Apollo 17, they drove more than 22 miles.
You mean like 11 miles out, 11 back?
Well, they did it in three sorties each. So they
accumulation.
Nine drives altogether on those three missions.
What would have happened if they were 7 miles out and the rover broke down? How would they have gotten back? Would they have made it?
Well, the NASA had thought of that, of course, and they never got 7 miles out for that very reason. The farthest out that they got on 17 was about 4.72 miles, and that was pretty close to the practical edge of their travels. Any farther, and they wouldn't have time to do science. And still be able to get back to the lunar module on foot if something happened to the rover. So it was built into the calculations for each mission. How far, can we allow these guys to go and still get them back safely if the rover, breaks down? And the limitation, of course, was the backpacks they wore, which had a finite amount of air and cooling water in them. On the rover missions, generally they would drive out to the farthest point of the day's activities first and then gradually work their way back towards the lunar module as the day progressed and as their stores of air and cooling water were depleted.
We're with Earl Swift. His book is called Across the Airless Wilds. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Describe, if you can, for us, Earl, the Rovers.
Well, they were aluminum, folding go-karts. They weighed less than 500 pounds, 460-odd pounds, each of them. They carried two astronauts. They were powered by two batteries. As I mentioned, they had these four tiny electric motors, one in each wheel. Those motors were mated to strange little transmissions. It only had three parts, only two of which moved, but gave translated that pretty anemic dribble of power from the electric motors into a surprising amount of torque, enough to get the rovers up hundreds of feet up the sides of mountains. The wheels in which those motors and transmissions were mounted were made of zinc-coated stainless steel piano wire that was woven into a tight mesh.
You couldn't get a flat tire on the moon.
Right. You can't take a pneumatic tire to the moon because it's subjected to extremes of heat. We're talking plus or minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit, so huge ranges of heat or cold.
Or cold, that's right.
Yeah, depending on whether you're in the sun or the shade. And, you're subjected as well to a constant bombardment of cosmic radiation and micrometeorites that are the size of grains of sand but moving faster than bullets and can do damage. Clearly rubber would have broken down right away. So a pneumatic tire was out of the question, not only for that reason, but as you say, if they got a flat, they would be in big trouble.
How much do you think they cost, each rover?
Each rover cost, if you break down all of the costs of the program and split it by three, about $13 million apiece.
Wow, that's an expensive car.
And those are 1971 dollars, 1970 dollars.
That's right.
Yeah, it's big bucks.
There were cameras mounted out there that were controlled remotely back at Houston. Mission Control.
That's true. In front of the passenger on the rover, up on the nose of the vehicle, there was a remote-controlled TV camera, pretty high resolution for the day, and it was controlled by an engineer at Mission Control. The same guy did it for each mission, a guy named Ed Fendell. And the astronauts would reach one of their stops in the course of their explorations and would aim a high-gain antenna at Earth. The high-gain antenna was the big inverted umbrella-looking thing that you see in pictures of the rovers. And it was necessary to aim that precisely to get a TV signal to transmit. And from that point on, the astronauts could work with all of us, back here on Earth, watching over their shoulders as they did.
It was exciting to watch. It really was.
It was.
Wasn't it?
It was. And compared especially to, you go back to those early missions again. The astronauts got out of the lunar module and they set up a camera on a tripod next to the module usually, and that camera didn't move much. It captured the astronauts bouncing around. You remember probably the really grainy, blobby views of astronauts bunny hopping around the rover or around the module, not doing anything particularly stirring. You couldn't really see well enough to tell what they were doing anyway. And then if they went off camera, they were off camera. The camera did not follow them. And so it was not great TV. And then when you get to the rovers with Apollo 15, suddenly you're in moonscapes without earthly equivalent, because the places they sent the rover missions were far more dramatic just in topography than the flat, featureless lunar deserts that the early missions favored. And you got to go along on the ride. It was pretty amazing.
Earl, who came up with the idea for the rovers?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, if you go back to the very beginning, I mean, the origin story really starts in 1952 with Wernher von Braun, he was part of a team that wrote a series of stories for Collier's magazine, in which they laid out what a future moon mission looked like. Would look like. And the point of the series was really to discuss the inevitability of America going to space. In 1952, von Braun was convinced that it was going to happen. And he described this mission in which three rockets would land on the moon with several dozen astronauts aboard, and they'd unload this big tank-like Caterpillar tractor sort of rover with a pressurized cabin. And a bunch of astronauts would climb aboard, and they'd ride around in shirt sleeves, say, you know, air-conditioned comfort, and go on these ambitious odysseys of 250 to 500 miles.
Hold on, Earl. We're going to hit a break. We'll come back and pick it up right there. Earl Swift with us across the airless wilds. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Earl Swift with us across the airless wilds. Interesting title, by the way, Earl.
Well, thank you. It's accurate because of all the other hazards the astronauts encountered on the moon. The one that I think stands apart is, you know, there was no air. They were driving around in a hard vacuum. Tearing their suit would have killed them within seconds.
Let's pick up that Van Braun story again. So he was featured on Collier's Magazine with equipment we still haven't brought to the moon yet. Not like that.
Well, that's true, but this is 1952, and it was, you know, I hesitate to even call it nonfiction because it was so futuristic. But, you know, that this is 6 years before Sputnik, and the American public reading this in a serious magazine like Collier's didn't, you know, they were astounded. And, you know, space fever kind of took hold of the country for a brief while. That was amplified further when Walt Disney invited Von Braun onto his Disneyland TV show twice in 1955. Up until then, Von Braun hadn't been the household name that he would become. Disney made him that, and he became the face of America's future in space.
Was he controversial? I mean, he was a Nazi, and he did develop the V-2 rocket.
He was a problem. He was a Nazi, and it's true that he was an SS officer as well, and the V-2 was a weapon of mass destruction that was intended to kill allies, i.e. us. And most problematic, the people who built the V-2 in large part were concentration camp slave labor, you know, victims of the concentration camps who were herded into an underground factory to build the V-2 and who died by the thousands in the process. And Michael Neufeld, who I think has written the best biography of Von Braun, has surmised that he very likely could have been tried as a war criminal.
That's true.
Instead, the U.S. military snuck him into the States after the war. He and 100-odd of his German engineers.
And the Russians got some, too, didn't they?
They did, and that was the whole point of sneaking him in. There was a judgment made that he was more valuable to the U.S. alive than he was valuable to humanity, I guess, dead. And he was brought in specifically to help the U.S. develop missiles. And went to work first at Fort Bliss outside of El Paso, and then after a few years was moved to Huntsville, Alabama, to the Redstone Arsenal, which, once NASA was created, became the Marshall Space Flight Center, and he was made its director.
Well, and wasn't he instrumental in developing those rockets that got our astronauts into space?
No question. Yeah, he and his German engineers led the effort, really marshaled the effort to build all of the Saturns and the forerunners that made the Saturns possible.
And, did the rovers that were ultimately made different from some of the plans that they had originally?
Well, it's interesting. There's a certain slow evolution that the thinking went through. If you go back to that 1952 Collier story and reflect that Von Braun is talking about a rover vehicle, you know, this big pressurized tank, so big and heavy that it required its own rocket to go to the moon. And jump ahead 10 years to NASA's early plans for a rover, and they looked pretty similar. I mean, they
huge.
NASA was still talking about a really big, hulking, pressurized behemoth of a vehicle. That would travel long distances, that would serve not only as transportation but also as shelter. So the astronauts would land in their lunar module, which hadn't been designed yet, and they'd get out and they'd get in this giant rover, and they'd live in that thing for 2 weeks, and they'd drive, you know, 250 miles, do their explorations, eventually drive back to base camp,
Did they have any idea how they're going to get this up there?
Well, it would have required its own Saturn V. It would have required two Saturn V's per mission. And ultimately, that's what killed it. Later in the 1960s, when NASA's budget started to be trimmed, it became obvious that the agency was not going to be able to keep building Saturn V's. They were enormously expensive. And so production was capped. Two Saturn V missions were nixed. And at that point, NASA kind of walked away from the whole rover idea. There was always the expectation that Apollo was going to be the first chapter in a long lunar campaign, that there would be follow-up programs that would last for decades to come. And so I don't think there was a lot of panic within NASA when, in 1967, they pretty much killed all the contracts looking into rover projects, because they figured, okay, well, you know, we won't get it done in Apollo, but it'll be coming down the road soon enough. By this time, a lot of engineers working in for the private sector who had been getting contracts from NASA to do the, you know, the important basic work on rover design, they had a lot of years invested in the process, and they were not willing to just walk away. So several companies on their own dime continued the development work, and in particular, an engineer at General Motors, a defense research lab that General Motors had in Santa Barbara, California, made a decision that he was going to figure out how to shrink this concept to the point where he could get it to shoehorn aboard into a very tiny space on the existing lunar module.
Was that Sam Romano?
Well, Sam Romano was his boss. The engineer was a guy named Ference Pavlik.
Ah.
And Ference Pavlik spent 4 months working on developing a way to origami a tiny car by folding it twice over into a bundle that was about the size and shape of a pup tent.
Where did it go? I mean, you had three astronauts in the Apollo capsule. So where was this?
This was in the lunar module. So this is in the lander. And the lander was that odd-looking thing that looked like a plant stand with a doorknob on top of it. It was...
And how it flew was amazing.
Well, it's the oddest flying machine ever developed, probably. And it's really the only flying machine that's ever been developed that was never intended for use on Earth. I mean, there's no way it would fly on Earth. It had to be in space. And it had two parts. You had the doorknob part that the two astronauts rode in, which was called the ascent stage. And then you had a kind of a squarish platform with legs sticking out of its corners that doorknob was attached to, and that was called the descent stage. It had the big engine that allowed the lunar module to come down softly onto the lunar surface. In that lower stage, there was a wedge-shaped hole exactly the size of the bundle that Ference Pavlik was able to fold the rover into. So he built a 1/6 scale model of this, put a G.I. Joe action figure in the driver's seat, and took it to Huntsville, showed it to Von Braun, and the legend is that Von Braun slammed his hand down on his desk and said, "We must do this," and the rest is history.
But it didn't go that smoothly, did it?
Well, once the contracts were let, there were only 17 months left until this thing had to be delivered if it was going to make it into the program. And that was a tiny fraction of the time, less than half of the typical Apollo hardware timetable. I mean, that was a rush job and then some. And they not only had to build the rover in that time, they had to design it and test it.
So and test it, that's right.
This monumental, frantic effort began all over the country. There were pieces of it being built in several locations. Boeing was the prime contractor. General Motors was its chief subcontractor, and they got it done. It busted its budget twice over. It looked like there was no way it was going to make the deadline for Apollo 15, but they actually delivered it 2 weeks early.
It's exciting, just exciting. I mean, they must have been elated when they saw these things working on the moon?
Oh, I think that NASA was shocked by how transformative it was. You know, everybody knew going in that it was going to change things. But I don't think they appreciated just how much of a difference, not only in range, I mean, it was obvious that it was going to change the range that the astronauts could travel. But the other big difference it made was that it enabled the astronauts to spend more time outside of the lunar module.
And you could put rocks in it and stuff like that,
you
right?
You could. You could load it up to twice, you know, it could carry twice its weight. It only weighed, you know, 460 pounds again. So, you know, most cars and trucks on Earth are designed to carry less than half their weight. This thing, as gossamer light and frail as it appeared to be, was really a pretty sturdy little craft.
Were there some concerns about them going, we talked about this briefly, too far?
Well, they were kept from going too far. You know, the limits of the consumable life support in those backpacks they wore, that really kind of dictated everything that happened outside. Now, one of the advantages that the rover brought was, you know, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were walking around in Apollo 11, they were wearing a suit that was essentially, it's like wearing 20 raincoats, one over the other.
All at the same time, yeah.
Yeah, and then pumping it up, you know, to the stiffness of an all-season radial with air, to the point where you just to move your arm or to close your fist requires a great deal of muscle. And, you know, they get exhausted pretty quickly. It looks like they're having a lot of fun bunny hopping out there on the lunar surface.
And if they had fallen, like on their back, could they have gotten up?
Well, Charlie Duke on Apollo 16 did fall on his back, and he got up in a hurry because he was afraid that he had hurt his backpack. Yeah, they could. They were so light, you know. I mean, it's 1/6 gravity, so it's...
That helped. But, I mean, you would think they couldn't stabilize themselves with all that excess material.
Yeah, I mean, that suit and the backpack together weigh way more than the astronaut does. So it definitely changes your center of gravity, changes your sense of balance. You can't see your own feet from inside your helmet. You know, you're exerting a lot of energy just to do simple chores and to make simple movements. And consequently, you burn through your air and cooling water pretty quickly. Your metabolic rate is sky high, and you are just charging through all of those supplies, which limits how much time you can spend outside the lunar module. And what the rover did was, in addition to give the astronauts exploration that was measured in miles instead of minutes, it gave them time because there were cool downs built into every day's work. They'd drive the rover out to, you know, several miles out to a scientific station that they had to explore, exerting very little energy in the process of driving out there. They would get out, they would do their scientific work. You know, they'd work up a sweat doing that, but then they'd get back into the rover. Their metabolic rates would drop back down. They'd drive to the next science stop. And so they wound up being able to spend a lot more time outside. And that was a game changer as well.
If and when we go back, will they have the same kind of rovers, or will they be even more sophisticated after 50 years?
That's a great question, because a lot of the concepts that have come and gone in the years since have, ironically enough, been a return to that 1952 vision that Von Braun described in Collier's magazine. They've been pressurized, long-distance sorts of machines rather than the little open jeep that the rover was. But I think you'd probably see a combination. That would be my guess, beginning with open jeeps. You know, I think we'd have to take baby steps first.
I think so, too. Would there be anything new that they'd bring out there that we haven't even thought about?
Oh, I'm sure. I don't know what it would be, because I haven't thought about it. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting when you talk to the guys who built the Apollo rover, and there are quite a few of them still alive and still sharp as a tack. You ask them, you know, if you could change anything about the rover, you know, with all of the advances that have happened in the years since, you know, in materials and whatnot, if you could change the rover, would you? Or would you wind up sending essentially the same machine up?
Same thing, yeah.
And the answer you get is usually, well, certainly there would be some swap outs of materials because, you know, we'd use lighter metals, we'd use some carbon fiber maybe. But in general, the rover worked almost flawlessly. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. So it's hard to come up with improvements on something that was pretty close to perfect.
Earl, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back at the top of the hour and take phone calls with our incredible audience. Our special guest tonight, Earl Swift. His book is called Across the Airless Wilds. We'll have him tell you where you can get that, too. The cover's fantastic. I'll have him explain that as well. And his website is his name, earlswift.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with your phone calls, your questions, your stories next on Coast to Coast AM.